You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, my bookshop, and one of the few independent bookshops in the area. We're actually today, in celebration of the publication of Family Life by our guest today, Ahil Sharma, we're going to be, our front table will be stocked with his book. The book is the story of the Mishras and their youngest son, Ajay, and his struggle and perhaps his triumph over being a new immigrant in America, how America offers us such promise, but sometimes such frustration. And the book is about kind of like a tragic situation, how it's dealt with by a family. And then that overlaid with that is the actual immigrant experience of growing up in America. Ahil is the author of Obedient Father, his first novel, which won the Penn Hemingway Award and a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. His short stories are everywhere, in the New Yorker and the Atlantic. His story, Cosmopolitan, was in the Best American Short Stories of 1998 and made into a movie. Several O. Henry awards for short stories. And it's funny, we were just saying before we started, I've subscribed to The New Yorker for so long that, you know, you can look at the digital edition, and when you do that, you can go back, and since there's so many great short stories that he's written, you can go back and find them all and read them as well. So welcome, Ahil, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Your book, as I said, comes out today, and, you know, we can talk later about its autobiographical nature, but one of the things that was funny with your interview with Mohsin Hamid was that you said, you talk about, he asked you, the book took 13 years to write, and you say you feel more comfortable saying 12. Why is that?
You know, I want to diminish the horror.
Well, you could have said 5 then instead of 12.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm comfortable with sort of fudging the truth. I'm not comfortable with totally lying. Like my wife, when I met my wife, she measured my height, uh-huh. And I'd always said that I was 5'6", and it turns out I'm 5'5.5". And I said, lie to me, because if you're 5'6", you can round up to 6 feet.
It's so funny because at my bookstore, I bring back gifts when I go places. I bring them back to the staff, and one of the staff members said to me, "I said, you know, I have new gifts for you in the back." And she says, "You know, I probably shouldn't say this, but I never like anything you bring back." And I thought, well, she could just take it and throw it in the trash can on the way out. At least I'd feel better. But the reason, when you said 12 years, it reminds me of things that I also do. And it's funny, I will be interviewing Mr. Hamid regarding how to get rich, filthy rich in Rising Asia in the next couple of weeks, I think. Mm-hmm. And the interview you had with him was great. And when I first read The Reluctant Fundamentalist, I bought 10 copies of it and distributed to as many Republicans as I knew. Mm-hmm. To try to explain to them how you could become what we call a terrorist simply mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. of the way you're treated in America sometimes. So instead of me talking constantly, why don't you tell us a little bit about the book and how it came to be and why it took so long for it to come to fruition?
The book is semi-autobiographical. It draws very heavily on my life, it's a book about, you know, when I was my family came to America in 1979. We lived in Queens for about 2 years, and then it was me, my older brother, and my parents. And you know, my brother was very smart, and you know, after being in America for 2 years, he took the exams to get into the Bronx High School of Science, which is this very competitive school in New York, public school, and he got in, which is an extraordinary achievement. And between the the summer between 8th and 9th grade, right before he was about to start, we went to Virginia to visit relatives, and he was an enthusiast. You know, he was very energetic, and he loved trying new things, and he dived into a swimming pool and he struck his head on the bottom of the pool, and it stunned him, and he remained underwater for about 3 minutes. And then when he was pulled out, it took a while to be able to for him to get oxygen, for his brain to get oxygen. And by the time that happened, he had become severely brain damaged. That is, he could no longer walk or talk. He could not roll over in his sleep. He wasn't able to feed himself. He had to be fed through a gastrointestinal tube. I mean, just true horror after horror after horror. And my parents took care. He was in the hospital for about 2 years, and then my parents couldn't bear the idea of for two reasons. They couldn't bear the idea of letting him remain in the hospital, because the care one gets at a hospital is okay, but is not that great. And two, they didn't want to go to the hospital every day, and so they decided to take him out of the hospital and move him to the house that we had bought and begin taking care of him there. This, of course, was a disaster. The pressure of taking care of somebody so damaged is enormous, and the pressure of taking care of somebody so damaged when you have no money is almost incomprehensible. You know, it's like being at the bottom of an ocean. All the worry about insurance, all the, not being able to hire good nurses and nurses' aides, because you just can't afford to pay market rate, and so you're getting really terrible nurses and nurses' aides, people who will steal from you if there's anything left out in public. And so the story is based on that. One of the reasons it took such a long time to write this is because the subject matter feels so grim. It's so grim that it almost resists being turned into a narration. It's also plotless. Event occurs and then there are repercussions, but they don't cascade in a consistent way, the way a plot would work. Causation doesn't work in a consistent way. You know, A occurs and then B occurs, but A occurs and then F occurs as well. I'm not sure if I'm making sense.
Yeah, you are, because especially when you talk about how you like exposition better mm-hmm. than narrative, and I feel the same way. It's like Nabokov, you can compare Cosmopolitan a little bit to Nabokov, but it's like when you read something like Transparent Things, it's like the idea of objects in a room have always struck me as being sometimes very poignant.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
So I wrote and rewrote, and it was hard to write this book for many, many reasons. One was simply that your artistic instincts are thrown off when you're writing from life. Because if I'm describing a room, if it's purely fictional, I can just say a few things and I feel like I've conjured the room. But if I'm writing from life, I just put in a few things and I feel, oh, but what about all these other details? The other details press on me. And so in a very basic way, I was thrown off. And yes. Then my response to my parents, to my life kept changing. Some days I would be writing and I would be thinking of my parents and I would get angry. And some days I would be thinking of my parents and I would feel enormous tenderness. And so it was hard to maintain a consistent tone. It was just very difficult in many ways. For me, there was a lot of why the book got done, that I was able to finish it, was partially I find that I changed as a person.
Yeah,
you did. Know, that at a certain point I just had to do, you know, spending so much time thinking about my parents, I just began to think, you know, that my parents didn't do the best that they could. They didn't even do the best that they knew how. But they gave me what they had. You know, they were angry people, and so they gave me anger. You know, they were frightened people, and so they gave me fear.
You have, and maybe you still have, I don't know, a great deal of anger. And even in the short story, which kind of almost telegraphed your novel, which is Butter, which came out in late 2013, The New Yorker, you deal with a great deal of anger, even with that. You could tell the story about your restaurant experience at Per Se, mm-hmm. where I had a similar experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have a great deal of anger. It's sort of the anger of, like, why did this happen, right? And
but it happened so long ago. How can you hold on to it now? Do you hold on to it now?
I don't actually feel that I do. I think that it gets refreshed when I'm in new environments.
Hmm.
You know, when I'm in new environments, I find myself pushed to who I used to be, especially in new environments where there's anxiety.
It's interesting because, you know, you made your job very difficult because you've spoken about how you did not really want to have this be a memoir, but at the mm-hmm. same time you said everything in it, pretty much everything in it is true. And then it's a novel or styled as a novel, so you don't have the luxury of being able to lie at will like you could in a novel. You know what I mean? And then you're stuck. I'm telling the truth, but how can I make it be a story? It's a very difficult task you set for yourself.
I'll just say that this is a novel and that about 70% of this is true and about 30% is made up stuff.
Okay.
That is, you know, I don't remember the things that people said, and so all the dialogue is made up. I collapse time. I combine characters. I do all sorts of things which are not true to what occurred in my life. So I think of it as a novel. I felt a strong desire to write, to try to draw as much from life as possible, partially as a way to redeem that experience. You know, all these things occurred, and they're going to get forgotten. You know, because my parents are ordinary people, and my brother was an ordinary boy. And they're going to get forgotten. That's just the way it is for ordinary people. And I wanted to memorialize them. You know, I wanted to preserve them so that people could look back at pieces of them and feel the dignity that art conveys.
I'll give you an idea of how, as a reader, or at least me as a reader, one of the most poignant scenes in the book is when your brother suffers from pneumonia. And the mm-hmm. upshot of that is prior to pneumonia, when a loud sound would occur in a room, he would turn his head toward it.
Mm-hmm.
And then after
mm-hmm.
the pneumonia, he could no longer do that. And for some reason, that really kind of broke my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that's true. That's
yes,
what happened.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and that's a common experience for people who, people who've had injuries like that, that the devastation gets worse over time. I mean, I wanted this book to be useful, you know, and I mean that in sort of the most weird and cliched way, which is, you know, we all know people who are ill or have been ill or who've suffered loss. I mean, we all know them, and we're certainly all going to experience this, you know, that our loved ones are going to get sick. And I find that there's something about art, and especially art that looks at this, which by showing this world and showing that how we endure it and how we can process it, that this is helpful to us. You know, it leads us through these very difficult times. And I wanted, so I mean, we're talking about this thing as a grim story. whereas I also sort of feel, or I'm describing it as a grim story. I'll take responsibility for that. I mean, I view this book as sort of just enormously full of life and humor.
Apparently, lots of people agree with you because the people that have commented on the book, David Sedaris, one of the world's greatest humorists, Gary Steingart, who I interviewed 2 weeks ago on Little Failure, when you had your interview with Mr. Hamid, he talked about laughing through the book, and even when it got heartbreaking, he was still laughing. And why do you think it is that, as you describe it again, and taking responsibility for it being a grim story, which it is, and, you know, even your dedication says, to my poor brother, why do you think that so many people who are so funny find it so funny?
You know, I think, you know, when you're describing somebody you love, right?
Yeah.
And you're describing them doing weird things, the person doesn't appear strange, but, or the person is strange, but you don't view that person is not diminished by his strangeness. You know, the person is idiosyncratic and yet loved.
Well, talk about how you would come home from school and the things you would say to your brother, even though he couldn't respond. Some of those things.
I mean, I was thinking of that. I was also thinking of how, you know, I describe my father as one of these, you know, my father is a weird guy. And I remember at one point he, you know, just sort of out of nowhere, he offered up the fact that he had always known I was selfish. And I asked him why, you know, and he said that when I was a little kid, I would start crying whenever he wanted to watch TV. And so I wouldn't let him watch TV. And this was like 35, 36 years ago. And to me, that's a weird thing. But the fact that the character, the Ajay who represents me, then begins tickling his father.
Yeah.
And making fun of him shows how much affection he has. And I feel that the book, even when it's representing these characters behaving in odd ways, that affection makes us appreciate them and value them. You know, that if the narrator is valuing these characters, then we as readers begin to value them as well.
It's like I said, when you come home from school and you berate your brother, even though he's comatose, and you say, "What have you been doing? Nothing today. You've just been slacking off." That kind of thing.
Right.
And I think that's what people. Go ahead.
Or when the mother and Ajay, the narrator, play cards and have you know, Hughes and they have Birju having cards as well, and they steal his cards. And cheat him and then complain to him that he's a bad player.
And that's what David Sedaris and Gary Steingart see as the humor behind the pathos here, and I can understand it too. And that's what people do, and it helps them survive, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. You talk about this your book in like the Joycean sense, like a little bit of it being like Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, with you being Stephen Dedalus. I could ask if you have a Ulysses in mind, because Stephen Dedalus continues in there, but that would be pretty hard. But the one thing I remember, you know, in Portrait of the Artist, how Stephen wouldn't sit down with his mom when she was dying, when she asked him to pray, and he wouldn't pray with her. And that brought to mind how much praying there is in this book. So maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about the people who came to cure your brother, the people that came to get blessings from your mother, because in the Indian tradition, that was the way things work. If you could tell us a little bit about that.
You know, in the Indian Hinduism, one aspect of it is many people feel that they have a personal relationship with God. And that personal relationship extends to things like believing that, you know, God will visit them in dreams and offer them advice as to what to do. And I describe Indians this way, but there are many Christians who are also religious in such idiosyncratic ways. So what used to happen to my family, to my brother, is that we would have all these people visit who to try to wake my brother. And these were not gurus or priests. These were engineers, accountants, candy shop owners, engineers. And they would come and they had somehow concocted weird cures, like rubbing my brother with turmeric, or, shouting at my brother, or, making him drink strange potions. And they would do these things. I remember the very first time this occurred, I actually felt kind of important. The first time we had some stranger coming, I thought, oh, we're important enough for strangers to visit. When it went on, though, I began to feel really scared, because it made me feel that my parents didn't know what they were doing. To me, it was obvious that my brother was not going to get better. To my mother, however, there remained hope that she can keep opening doors one after the other, and at some, perhaps behind one door, some door would be a cure, would be a way that my brother could get better. And, to me, that's very human, that's very ordinary. That, of course, if it were my child, I would have behaved the same way. Would behave the same way.
It's like the relatives of the Malaysian airliner now. Mm-hmm. No one knows what happened to it. So if it was me, I would still have hope that my wife or my daughter or my nephew would still be alive. There's no closure.
And so my mother kept trying these things. But it scared me. It scared me that we were doing things that were irrational, that we had made decisions. Because part of the motivation, I believe, for my mother bringing my brother home was she wanted to try these different cures.
Yeah, but it wasn't just that, too. There were people coming to your mother as supplicants.
Yeah. There was, we tend to, we Indians tend to believe that people who are very virtuous are almost holy, right? Sort of similar to Catholic saints.
Right.
And not only are they virtuous, but they're holy. And not only are they holy, they have the characteristics of holy people. That is, their blessings have enormous power. So we would have people visit, especially before the SATs, and ask for my mother's blessings for their kids.
And then they didn't do any better, but they still thought she had done it.
Yeah, it could have been worse if it weren't for her.
That sounds more like my tradition, the Jewish tradition. Could have been worse. That's really funny.
I say these things, and I just want to say that I believe that what the book expresses is tremendous affection towards this community. So many of the people that we knew helped us, went out of their way to take care of us, coming when we didn't, coming to our house when we didn't have a nurse's aide, and helping to move my brother from his wheelchair to his bed, or coming when we were having problems with people who knew plumbing, coming to our house when we were having problems with our plumbing and fixing it. And I hope that, you and I are talking about the most idiosyncratic aspects of the novel, but the quieter aspects of the novel are this, this tenderness that so many people showed us.
Yeah, and you talk about that in your other interviews as being the exposition part of it also is being kind of universal, mm-hmm. and almost like an everyman kind of story, like almost like a platonic ideal. Mm-hmm. And I see what you mean by that. The only one I wouldn't see would be, what about the one woman who your mother didn't like, but then she wanted your mother to help her, and then you went to dinner there, mm-hmm. and then your mother kind of gave her her comeuppance. Tell that story.
Well, nobody behaves perfectly, right? And so in the novel, there's a character who begins to behave rudely towards the mother figure. And after I got into Princeton, I got invited to, because we Indians, we love, we love these sort of high-status universities. My mother and I began being invited to all of these people's households because they wanted us to come and meet and have their children meet me. So I would go, And one of the character, and here I'm combining characters and people that we dealt with in real life. My had behaved very badly, and the way to respond to bad behavior, in sort of a very Indian way to respond to bad behavior, is not open confrontation, but making yourself so pathetic and wretched, you know, before this person, saying, "Hey, I'm so stupid, I'm this and that," that the other person is reminded of how they had. The other person can interpret this sort of self-diminishment, this self-abasement, as reminding them that, oh, you insulted me, you made me feel like I was stupid and unimportant, and now you're seeking me out. So that's the dynamic that occurs there.
Yeah, that was actually a very comical scene at mm-hmm. the dinner table, and you know your participation in that was also kind of funny too. I mean, the woman was just trying to get—I don't know what she was trying to get out of your mother. She was trying to get her son to be as successful as you, and your mother kept saying, "Oh no, why ask me? You know, I'm not nearly as smart as you are." And the repartee between the two of them really did become quite humorous.
Mm-hmm. So what? Yeah, so much suffering, you know, there's so much suffering when you're powerless. And, you know, when you're powerless, the way you fight back oftentimes is by, you know, you tend not to be openly confrontational, because who knows what might happen to you. And so you begin, you know, you hate in a secret way, or you attack in these weird guerrilla movements. And that's sort of what occurred there. It's the opening of Father Karamazov mm-hmm. has Father Karamazov going around to his neighbors who are much better than he is, and telling them that his wife beats him, just to make them show through his degradation that is the world that they too live in, that this degradation can reach out and touch them. That's the same movement that is mimicked in that scene.
It's funny because in a different context, you do kind of the same thing when you're a young student, is that you want to figure out how to be Hemingway, but instead of reading The Sun Also Rises or Farewell to Arms or The Old Man and the Sea, you read critical essays regarding Hemingway, mm-hmm. and then you write from that. You know, and some of your Hemingway is really good. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that the excerpts you put in there that you wrote, I thought were really good?
Yeah, they were the things that I wrote when I was in ninth or tenth grade, when I was reading Hemingway. I remember, you know, the thing that I put in about the brother.
Yeah.
I remember waking up one night because of my brother coughing downstairs and not being able to go back to sleep, and wanting to turn it into art. You know.
You did. This, it's just like everybody says about Hemingway. It's this simplicity that creates, you know, this genius. The words are so small, mm-hmm. almost like haiku. You know, it's like that.
Yeah, you want to at least for me. In my family, almost nobody reads. When I write, I aim for my parents, you know, or for their friends, that is, you know, for whom a book is not the thing that they turn to for comfort or for answers. And I want it to be something that they can enter into, that they can feel that the world of these books, the prose of this, what I write, I want them to be comfortable in it. And I want to show to them that this is immediately helpful, you know, that this is useful to them. And I keep turning back to the word useful. Fitzgerald said that a book should demand to be read. And I feel that the way that I try to demand to be read, or this book demands to be read, is that it says, you know, I'm going to give you something so useful, so important and helpful to you, that of course you need to read this thing, because, look, this will take care of you. You know, this will help you out. This is good for you.
It compels you, too. I mean, that's why I read it in one sitting, which unfortunately, due to you, I only got 3 hours of sleep that night. But, well, how did your family, your long-suffering parents, feel about this book? And your neighbors from back then, have they read it?
They have not read it. My mother, when I was telling her that I was writing this book, said to me, Akhil, you know, just make me look good. And my father said to me, I asked him if he wanted to read it. And he said, why? I was there.
Once again, it just sounds like my Jewish family. It's the same kind of expression I would hear when I was growing up. What's funny is that when you were talking about something that happened 36 or 37 years ago, especially for a novelist, is that look how clearly you remember and can portray in words that little incident with your father where he said he knew you were selfish and the tickling. Those are seminal moments in your life, obviously.
You know, they're important moments, but I think that, you know, I use much less physical description in this book than I did in my first one.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think it's because this book is so full of affection. You know, it's so full of love for these characters that when we as readers need less physical description when we can feel the love that the author has, because then we're already comfortable. You know, there's no wariness on the part of the reader. The reader just feels like, okay, everything is going to be okay. I don't need to worry as to where exactly I am. There's none of that anxiety of knowing where the door to the room is.
Well, that's kind of true, and I don't want to give away anything from the book, but, you know, sometimes a reader will read a book and at the end knows, okay, that's the end of the book, yep, it's done, I understand everything that happened. And sometimes at the end of the book, the reader has questions and the author has left this job to the reader to decide. And I think you kind of did that in this book, because you kind of left it to the reader to decide, where is he now? What does that mean? Or something like that.
Right. And yeah, the book has two beginnings and two endings.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And the ending that you're referring to is sort of the ending of remembrance of things past. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I need to go write all of this down, or the ending of the way of all flesh. It's part of that tradition.
Yeah, but that's the thing about you, is that you talk about this love and affection and care for one another, and the fact that that's human and universal. But at the same time, you have not talked that much about the fact that, and I especially found it true when I went back and read the Butter story, which is really just a narrative of one page, that it's again that anger. There's part of you that still has this anger, and I want to know, I guess, what you intend to do with it for the rest of your life.
You know, I went to see my parents recently, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, my parents couldn't pick me up, so I walked from the train station to my parents' house, which is about 2 miles. And most of the road doesn't have sidewalks. So I'm walking along the road, and as I'm walking along, some guy drives by and throws a bottle at me. And, you know, this is Edison, New Jersey, which is truly, at least my experience of it is that it's a tremendously racist place. It was much more when I was living there, when I was growing up there, but it still feels that way to me. And it could be simply that, you know, I still remember it that way, and so I'm projecting. So anyway, so this guy throws a bottle at me, and my first response is fear, and then is anger, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, a couple of days later, what I felt was, you know, thank God I'm not the sort of guy going around throwing stuff at people. You know, that at least I have moved on, you know, and the poor fellow who's doing this stuff. So I do feel anger, right? Of course I do, about all the things that have occurred. And I feel disappointment, and I feel disheartened about many things. But those are, you know, those are the things that I feel in the moment.
Yeah, I was just talking to someone today, a woman who was saying her husband had done this to her or whatever, and she'll never trust another man again. I said, no, that's wrong. You keep trusting, even if someone kind of screws you over. You keep trusting. If you stop trusting now, then that other person wins. You need to keep trusting. Or like with me and the gifts, I'm not going to stop giving this woman gifts because she says she doesn't like them. I will continue to be me. She's not going to change the way I am.
Right.
So, well, so
that's what I feel as well. You know that you can't I'm not sure who said this. I keep thinking it's St. Augustine, but I think it is not. Anger is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die.
Yeah.
And what good does it do me to be angry at that guy, you know? Or what good does it do me to be angry at things that occurred in my childhood?
Well, you did have a strange response, again, like you say, idiosyncratic response, when at school, just like you were talking about, you exaggerated the condition of your brother to students. Mm-hmm. Or when you were sitting at your table eating your Indian food as opposed to the more assimilated Indians who were eating American food, mm-hmm. And you talk about that in Butter, you almost wanted to make things seem worse so they would hate you more almost. It was a strange thing that you did.
Yeah, if we feel rejected, then we take that rejection and try to turn it into some badge. How people cultivate being a victim.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
And then turn that almost into aggression. You know, the way that Father Karamazov does. It's a very human experience. Or, you know, like gay pride, turning the word queer into something from something negative into something full of pride.
Yeah, America seems to breed almost like a Petri dish, that kind of response. Sometimes it takes a very passive-aggressive, which is almost worse than just being aggressive, mm-hmm. approach. And then sometimes it's, especially in our times now, if you go to a football game and you're the wrong racial type, you could get beaten up. Mm-hmm. And all you're mm-hmm. doing is just, you're not doing anything, you're just going to the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you haven't done anything. And somehow America, not that it doesn't happen in other countries, but somehow America seems to give rise to that. And you do underscore it because those boys who walked by you when you were eating lunch said horrible things to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you responded that you were eating snake.
Right. Yeah, you know, there's a difference between how kids behave, which is, you know, they're sort of, children are sort of half animals, and how adults behave, you know, so there's different levels of responsibility. That would be the first thing. I think that sort of really bad behavior is not, you know, we say that this is, you say, oh, America breeds, acts as, almost as a Petri dish. I would not agree with that. My experience of America has been, that America is much more protective of differences than almost anywhere else. That's my experience. If you were to go to India, for example, you know, that's a truly violent country where you have violence which is left unpunished. If you go to any other country, if you go to England, you're going to see similar issues of people being judged based on race or sexuality. So I don't think that it is unique to America, and I would actually say it might be a little bit better in America.
Well, I guess
that's my experience.
But yeah, and I understand and I agree with that. I guess what I'm saying is that maybe just in the past, or maybe since 9/11, or if you talk about a book like The Reluctant Fundamentalist, maybe just in the past, since 9/11, people have been very wary and sometimes aggressive in their position with regard to immigration, with regard to accepting other people's beliefs. I mean, I have seen that.
Certainly that is true, but also certainly, you know, we have recently much more effort oriented toward sort of changing immigration laws.
True.
So all of these things are occurring at the same time.
Hey, speaking of which, you have your law degree from Harvard, correct?
Yes.
Did you ever practice as an attorney?
Nope, I did not.
Do you ever have the desire to do that?
No. You know, it was, I went to law school just because, I wanted to make a living. I didn't want to be a poor writer. I didn't want to read menus right to left. That was my motivation. And then when I was in law school, I just realized, one of my professors said to me, Akhil, you're going to be invited to many feasts. And on those feasts, all you as a lawyer are going to get are crumbs. And so I just decided, let me go where there's actual money. And so I became a banker.
Well, you also tried screenwriting too, right?
Yeah, I did. When I graduated from Princeton, I thought, what can I do? I wanted to figure out a way to earn a living and be an artist. And
that's hard.
And yeah, it's incredibly hard. And I thought, maybe I can do something where I write for the movies, because that was all that I could really think of at that point. And so I went and I got into a talent development program that Universal Studios had, and so I wrote a couple of screenplays. But it wasn't, anything big.
I remember that when I went to law school, the only reason I did relatively well was because, just like you, I loved to read. Mm-hmm. And even just reading cases and reading the narrative of the case, which is kind of like the book you wrote, reading about how families... I could never understand how families could turn against each other for money. And then when I would be in estates and trusts or something like that, you'd read a case where it was brother against brother, or one family trying to divide up the money, like the Joe Robbie family or the Bacardi family. And I could never understand how it would be that a family could break its personal relationship up for money until I got out of law school. Then I understood it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very interesting experience for me. Do you find that you've now, what you're doing now is what you've always wanted to do? Do you find this is now where you want it to be?
This is a wonderful, I teach at Rutgers Newark in the MFA program. And the life of an academic is pretty fantastic. And I leave so much time to read and to think. I'm writing short stories, I'm writing essays. This is a wonderful life. I can't imagine a better one for me.
That's great. That's really, and that's one of those things that, like I try to do, is not to take for granted, So many people take their lives for granted, but it's nice to wake up in the morning and be happy mm-hmm. to go to work. It's one of the most wonderful things there is. Well, actually, on that note, that's how could you end an interview on a note other than you saying your life is a wonderful life?
Yeah, so it's great. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work to, at least for me, to manage my head. just because of sort of who I am and where I came from. But that effort is worth it.
Who are your favorite authors?
I tend to read and reread sort of the classics. So Thomas Hardy, Tolstoy, Chekhov.
Yes, me too. Dostoevsky, Nikolai Gogol. I just reread The Nose and the Overcoat. Laughed my ass off the other day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Kafka, Metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. I read pretty much 3 times a year.
mm-hmm.
Because, what is a better line than Gregor Samsa awoke one day from uneasy dreams to find himself transformed in his bed into a giant cockroach?
Yeah.
You really can't do any better than that, right?
Right.
So, anyway, and especially the Russians and the German authors, I really do like you. The problem I have at the bookstore is no one reads any of that stuff, so I can talk to them about that. But instead, they're going to buy your book or Gary Steingart's book or a book by Alice LaPant or some other book like that. So it's really hard. Thank God I have a staff that's conversant with new stuff, because if it was up to me, I'd take them back to the used section, and no one's really interested in that.
You know, I do feel that, you know, my book will sell a certain number of copies and hopefully will do well, but the books that keep on selling are these books. You know, it's, you know, it's astonishing how good you have to be any good at all. And certainly I've written, I mean, I feel like I've written a strong book, but I am not sure. I'm not sure if anybody would say it is anywhere as good as the greatest of these books.
Yeah, but no author. I mean, no author thinks that. I mean, I don't think any author would. How do I know? I mean, I love to write too, but I love to write not. Although in the beginning I used to write in the sense that I would see a dust jacket that said, you know, Sam Hankin, 29.95. But I don't do that anymore. I just write, and I don't have to worry about whether it's good or bad because it's just me. But it's a very good, it's as good as psychotherapy, obviously, right? Well, anyway, I have tons of questions and stuff like that. But what are you working on now? Are you working on a new novel? And how can you get away from this idea of being autobiographical?
You know, my first book had no autobiography in it at all. So for me, this was sort of a strange thing to do. Right now, I'm writing an enormous number of articles, you know, as part of, you know, this book publication. The next large project that I have in mind is a collection of short stories. Project I'm working on.
Were you happy when Cosmopolitan was made into a movie?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't. I didn't feel much one way or the other. I was glad for it. You know, this Family Life is on the was the cover review of this Sunday's New York Times Book Review.
Yeah, I saw.
And so, you know, I'm glad that this occurred, but it doesn't mean that much. The thing that really matters is, do I feel it's good, and do the people who matter to me think it's good? You know, the people that I respect.
Well, I certainly thought it was good, and like I said, when you read a book in one sitting. And also the other way I can tell is, like you were saying, is if I go back and read a paragraph, not because I didn't understand it the first time, but because the paragraph was so good, especially the one I point out, there were lots of them, the one where your brother not being able to turn his head at a loud sound, that was a very poignant paragraph, and it really, you know, got me in the guts, which I guess is what all authors are looking for. And basically, thank you for writing it, and thank you for coming here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, next week is another really good book. It's called A Circle of Wives by Alice LaPlante. It's a story of bigamy. Oh, no, it's a story of trigamy. There's three wives, and it's a story of a murder, and it's a story of a detective who's tracking down clues throughout the book, but sometimes, almost in the sense of Mr. Sharma's book, those clues lead back to her and her own life. So it's kind of a thriller. There's a romantic aspect of it, and there's also this kind of psychodrama to it as well. And she's a very nice lady, and I look very forward to talking to her next week. So hope you join us then, and thanks as always for listening to us here on The Avid Reader.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.